Welcome, back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Happy New Year to you all. Wow. Exciting stuff, isn't it? A new year, a new you, a new blah, blah, blah. Everything's off and racing. The A Year of War and Peace subreddit has started their yearly War and Peace reading again, which is pretty exciting. I've actually put my hand up to be a moderator over there, so I'm going to be running the first week of conversations. I'm going to be hosting the discussions, or like submitting the discussion for it, post I should say, just to help them get the ball rolling a bit. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird one, isn't it? New Year's, first day of a new year. It's got a strange feeling about it. Like, you kind of don't like how sentimental everyone gets about a new year. And then at the same time, you kind of feel that same sentimentality. Are things going to be better from now on? Is there any reason why a year should mark any significant change in the way the world operates? Probably just going to be more of the same. But I like seeing these people posting things like, you know, 2019 is behind us, then 2020 will be better and stuff like that. It's nice to have a bit of enthusiasm, a bit of optimism about the future. If I sound distracted, it's because something just gave me a real big splinter, like a mystery phantom splinter. I can't actually see it on my arm, and now I can't see anything on my table that would have done it, but something did it. Or maybe it just plucked an arm hair out. And by something, I mean it's this rickety old slapped together table made out of floorboards from my childhood home. I shouldn't say slapped together. It's actually very well made. It's just also more than 30 years old, and, you know, that's a good innings for a table. JMama8779 had this to say. Oh, yeah, hang on. First of all, part 6, chapter 5. The discussion prompt I left was, he punked out. What a punk. JMama said, I laughed out loud at the discussion prompt today. I was thinking the same thing, like, oh, what a wuss. Yeah, he really wussed out on that one. I'm Norwegian said, I'd like to change my answer back again. I have never asked anyone to marry me, but that build up to a question that fizzled out is something I've never seen described so well. I felt like I understood both characters perfectly, even when it's so easy to say, just ask her, you coward. Yeah, I've had that. I mean, I've never asked anyone to marry me, but I have had those moments where it's like, oh, I need, it's like something that we're both waiting for someone to step forward and say, you know, make a move, or not even, it's not even just exclusively for like romantic situations, but just when there's something that needs to be said and all that pressure builds, and the longer it goes on, the more awkward it seems to just say the thing. Very well portrayed in this chapter. Simply Productive said, oh, for Pete's sake, I have to say, I definitely see why this is on Hemingway's list, because honest to God, no other book reminds me of sheer human idiocy like this does. Sluggy with 3 G's said, I vividly remember this chapter from my first time reading the book years ago, and it was just as sad this time around. It's one of those instances where your entire life can change with just a sentence, and I think Tolstoy does a wonderful job showing how a right or wrong word can tip the balance one way or another. Returning home and going over all the arguments again, Sergei Ivanovich found that his deliberations had been wrong. He could not have betrayed Marie's memory. I wonder if this is the truth, or if it is just something he tells himself after the moment he has slipped through their fingers. Personally, I think he punked out and is trying to rationalize his behavior. Yep, I think so too. I think he punked out like a major, major punk. And I think he is just trying to rationalize it. For sure. He didn't not say it because he didn't want to disrespect his memories of his, you know, previous love. He didn't say it because he punked out. Chapter 6 goes like this. During the children's tea, the grown-ups sat on the balcony and talked as if nothing had happened, though they all, especially Koznishev and Varenka, knew very well that something had happened, which, though negative, was highly important. They both experienced what is felt by a pupil who has failed in an examination and has to remain in the same class or be finally expelled from the school. Everyone talked with peculiar animation about extraneous topics. Levin and Kitty felt particularly happy and in love with one another that evening. Their happiness in their love involved an unpleasant reflection on those who desired but had failed to secure the same happiness and made them feel ashamed. "Take my word for it, Alexander won't come," said the old princess. They were expecting Oblonsky by the evening train, and the old prince had written that he would perhaps accompany him. "And I know why," continued the princess. "He says young married folk should be left to themselves for a while." "Yes, Papa has really abandoned us," said Kitty. "We have not seen him, and are we young married folk? Why, we are such old ones now." "Only if he doesn't come, I too shall say goodbye to you children," said the princess with a sorrowful sigh. "Oh, what an idea, Mamma," rejoined both her daughters. "Just consider him, why, at present." And suddenly the old princess's voice unexpectedly quavered. Her daughters said no more and glanced at one another. "Mamma always finds something sad," this glance seemed to say. They did not know that pleasant as it was for her to stay with her daughter, and necessary as she felt herself to be there. She suffered keenly, both on her own and on her husband's account, since they gave their last and favourite daughter in marriage and the family nest was left empty. "What is it, Agatha Mikhailovna?" Kitty asked suddenly, when the old woman stopped in front of her with a look of mystery and importance. "How about supper?" "Oh, that's just right," said Dolly. "You go and give your orders, and I will hear Grisha his lesson. He hasn't done anything today." "That's a rebuke for me. No, Dolly, I will go," said Levin, jumping up. Grisha, who had entered a high school, had some homework to prepare during the summer holidays. While still in Moscow, Dolly had begun learning Latin with him, and on coming to the Levins made it a rule to go over with him at least once a day the most difficult lessons, Latin and arithmetic. Levin offered to replace her, but having once heard Levin giving the lesson and noticed that he was not doing it the same way as the master who had coached the boy in Moscow, she, though embarrassed and anxious not to offend Levin, told him resolutely that the textbook must be followed in the master's way and that she would rather give the lessons herself. Levin was vexed with Oblonsky for carelessly leaving it to the boy's mother to look after his lessons, which she did not understand, instead of doing it himself, and he was vexed with the masters also for teaching the children so badly. But he promised his sister-in-law to give the lessons in the way she wished. So he went on teaching Grisha not in his own way, but according to the book, and therefore did it half-heartedly and often missed a lesson. So it happened that day. "No, I will go, Dolly. You stay here," he said. "We shall do it all properly by the book. Only when Steva comes we shall go shooting, and then I shall miss the lessons." And Levin went off to find Grisha. Varenka spoke in the same way to Kitty. Even in the Levin's well-ordered household, she found ways to be of use. "I will see about supper," she said, "and you stay here," and she rose to accompany Agatha Mikhailovna. "Yes, do. I expect they could not get any chickens, but there are our own," answered Kitty. "Agatha Mikhailovna and I will arrange it," and Varenka went out with the old girl. Woman. "What a nice girl," said the princess. "Not nice, Mama, but so charming that there is no one else like her." "So you are expecting Stephen Arkadyevich tonight?" asked Koznishev, evidently disinclined to join in the conversation about Varenka. "It would be hard to find two brothers-in-law more unalike," he went on with his subtle smile. "The one always on the move, living always in society like a fish in water, and the other, our Constantine here, lively, quick, sensitive to everything, But as soon as he appears in society, either shutting up altogether or floundering about absurdly like a fish on dry land. Yes, he is very thoughtless, said the princess to Koznishev. I was just going to ask you to tell him that it is impossible for her, she indicated Kitty, to remain here, and that she must certainly come to Moscow. He says, get a doctor to come out here. Mama, he will do all that's necessary and will agree to everything, interpolated Kitty, annoyed with her mother for asking Koznishev's opinion on such a matter. In the midst of their conversation, they heard the snorting of horses and the scraping of wheels on the gravel of the avenue. Dolly had not had time to rise to go to meet her husband before Levin had jumped out of the window of the room below, where he had been teaching Grisha, and had lifted the boy out too. "It's Stiva," shouted Levin from under the balcony. "We're finished, Dolly, don't worry," he added, running like a boy to meet the carriage. "Is Ijus," shouted Grisha, hopping down the avenue. "And someone with him, it must be Papa," shouted Levin, who had stopped at the bend of the avenue. "Kitty, don't come down those steep steps. Go round." But Levin was mistaken in supposing that one of the men in the caliche was the old prince. When he came nearer, he saw, sitting beside Oblonsky, a stout, handsome young man wearing a Scotch bonnet with long ribbons streaming behind. It was Vazenka Veslovsky, a second cousin of the Shcherbatskys, a brilliant Petersburg, Moscow young man. "A most splendid fellow and a passionate sportsman," as Oblonsky said when he introduced him. Not at all dismayed by the disappointment he caused by appearing instead of the old prince, Veslovsky gaily greeted Levin, reminding him that they had met before, and lifting Grisha, he caught him up into the vehicle over the pointer Oblonsky had brought with him. Levin did not get in, but followed the caliche. He was rather vexed that the old prince, whom he liked more and more the better he knew him, had not come, and vexed because this Vasenka Veslovsky, a quiet, superfluous stranger, had come. Veslovsky seemed to him still more alien and superfluous when they arrived at the porch, at which the whole animated group of grown-ups and children had gathered, and he saw Vasenka Veslovsky kissing Kitty's hand with a particularly gentle, tender and gallant air. "We, your wife and I, are cousins and old acquaintances," said Vasenka Veslovsky, once again giving Levin's hand a very, very hard squeeze. "Well, is there any game?" asked Oblonsky of Levin, scarcely giving himself time to say a word of greeting to everybody. "He and I have the cruelest intentions. Why, Mama, they have not been in Moscow since then. Here, Tanya, that's for you. Please, get it out of the caliche behind there," he was saying to those about him. "How much refreshed you are looking, Dolly, dear," he went on, kissing his wife's hand and holding it in his own while he patted it with the other hand. Levin, who but a few moments before had been in the brightest of spirits, was now looking dismally at everyone, but dissatisfied with everything. Whom was he kissing yesterday with those same lips, he thought, as he looked at Oblonsky's caressing his wife. He looked at Dolly and was not pleased with her either. Of course she does not believe in his love, then why is she so pleased? Disgusting, thought he. He looked at the princess, who a few moments before had seemed so nice, and did not like the way she welcomed that beribboned Vasenka, as if to her own house. Even Koznishev, who had also come out of the porch, displeased Levin by the feigned friendliness with which he greeted Oblonsky, whom, as Levin knew, he neither liked nor respected, and Varenka, too, seemed disgusted because of the manner in which she, with her Sankt Nitouche, or wholly unapproachable air, made that gentleman's acquaintance, while all her thought was how to get married. But most repugnant of all was Kitty, for the way she fell in with the gay tone of that gentleman who appeared to consider his arrival in the country a regular festival for everybody, and particularly objectionable was the smile with which she responded to his smiles. Talking noisily, they all went into the house, but as soon as all were seated, Levin turned and left the room. Kitty noticed that something was wrong with her husband. She tried to seize an opportune moment to speak to him alone, but he hurried away from her, saying that he must go to the office. It was long since the farm work had seemed so important to him as it did that evening. For them it is always a holiday, he thought. Yet here we have work that is no holiday task, which cannot be put off, and without which life is impossible. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down. One chapter into a new year. What a bloody great thing that is. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.